Hi, Ken here. In nearly all of our podcasts, you hear students asking questions and their interaction with me. Many listeners find these exchanges illuminating because what is being asked is often exactly what is on their minds. If you find these conversations helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can maintain and expand our website. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, the nuts and bolts of practice variations.
So, recently, I've been experimenting with different kind of forms of meditation. So, following the breath is what I've always done since I began meditating, but recently have been involved with some sitting with a teacher who talks about reflective meditation, you know, actually kind of following the thoughts, and then reflecting on those afterwards, following sounds. You know, I sit at the beach, follow the waves. I guess what I'm wondering is, and it seems actually to be helpful to do different forms, but is it? I guess I've answered my own question.
Well, yes, but I think we can go a step further. How familiar are you with Alice in Wonderland?
I haven't read it recently, but as a child.
Compulsory reading for all serious practitioners. So Alice is, I think, wanders away from the... I can't remember what, actually. And she comes across a Cheshire cat sitting in a tree. And the cat is sitting with a grin. How many of you have seen a cat grin? And she says, "Please, sir, which way should I go?" He says, "That all depends. Where do you want to go?" "Well, it doesn't really matter," she says. "Then it doesn't really matter which way you go, does it?" "As long as I get somewhere," she says. "Well, if you go far enough, you'll be somewhere. So, where do you want to go?"
I guess where I want to go with my practice is in being able to sit with the pain and the emotions of life and not be so driven by them. To be able to sit and reflect on them. But ultimately, I guess for myself, because I deal with people dying, I want to be able to sit with my own death. So that's kind of where I guess that's why I practice. That's what drives me to it.
May I go a little further?
Yeah.
Why do you want to be able to sit with your own death?
Because I watch people resist it so, and I think that it doesn't have to be. And yet I can also be compassionate and understand it.
Yes. Well, this is quite wonderful. You have a very clear intention in your practice that makes things a lot simpler. Not necessarily easier, but a lot simpler. And could I borrow the book, please?
This is a most wonderful book.
That was unnecessary, but thank you. This is at the end of this book, but I write, if anything rattled you in the book, don't throw up. Let it work in you until the you that you are now is fatally poisoned. The importance of a conventional life is greatly exaggerated, and a good death can work wonders. So, as I understand, you want to know how to die.
I want to not resist it.
This is very deep. And I've long been under the feeling that, or of the opinion that, one of the most valuable things we can learn in our lives is how to die. There are many different forms of meditation. Meditation, it should be remembered, is a tool, not an end. It's a way of cultivating, bringing attention to what we experience. I don't know whether you ever read any of Carlos Castaneda. You may recall a distinction that Don Juan makes between dreaming and stalking. Resting with the breath, cultivation of attention that way, that's stalking. Opening to experience, and just opening and opening, being with whatever arises, is dreaming. In the beginning, our attention is usually so unstable, particularly in Buddhism, we put the emphasis on stalking. One of the unfortunate byproducts of that is that many people think that meditation means just that, or practice means just that. But sometimes it is good to reflect. I would not do them at the same time or in the same period. They're two different kinds of meditation. And one of the things that I often recommend to people, if I'm having them do something like death and impermanence meditation or loving kindness or any of the four immeasurables and so forth, is that they rest in the experience of breathing or whatever one day, and then they do this reflective practice the other day. They actually alternate, and they find quite helpful. Or you could do one at the beginning of the day and one at the end of the day if you're meditating twice a day. What is very important is to keep your intention in mind. So for you, you welcome every difficulty and every challenge in your life because it's practice for you. That's a difficult way to live, something I've not found very easy at all. But that goes to the heart of your intention. Any difficulty that comes, well, I'm going to have to experience this when I die anyway, so I might as well get started now. Does this help?
Very much.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
I'm a dabbler in a number of different kinds of meditation, including TM, Zen, and I've just been studying Vipassana recently. And when you asked us in the beginning about if we had any questions about what we were about to do, I wondered if we were all doing different kinds of meditation and what your expectations were there and if you advocate one kind.
Was there anybody doing something different from what I was doing? What are you really asking here?
I guess I'm asking if you advocate one technique to move down the road more efficiently.
Nineteenth century teacher in Tibet, one of the great teachers of the 19th century, once said, when you study or when you're learning, learn everything under the sun, everything that you can. When you reflect, keep your mind open like the sky. When you practice, pick one thing and go deep. Now, I have no idea what that one thing should be for you. And from the sound of it, you don't know at this point either. But in your exploring, it's possible that one day you'll meet a teacher or a practice or a tradition, or out of all of your exploring, something is going to come to you and say, "All any of those possibilities," and you say, "This is it." And then you just do it. Because back in the pioneering days, a person didn't need a bunch of different tools to build a cabin. They could do it all with an axe. They could chop down the tree, hew the logs, cut the notches, do everything. They could do everything with an axe. They really knew how to use an axe. And something happens when we take one technique and really, really come to know it very, very deeply. The Tibetans had an expression for this. In India, they practiced one deity and saw hundreds. We practiced hundreds and seen none. and it reflects what I'm trying to say here. You'll know when the time is right. It has to speak to you. And it will be your practice for a period of time. And that period of time may be the rest of your life, or it may be 5 years or whatever. One of the great teachers of the 11th century, a person called Chikawa Yeshu Dorje, fantastic scholar. I mean, just feats of memory that you would just leave your jaw dropping. Well-versed in all of the intricacies of very subtle and advanced techniques. And then he came across this technique called taking and sending, which consists of imagining taking in all of the suffering of others and giving your own happiness and joy to them, synchronizing that with the coming and going of the breath. And that was his practice. That's what he did for the rest of his life. That's what spoke to him. And I could give you other stories of other people I know who have found that one thing. And so you keep looking and you practice, you find what speaks to you, and then you know what to do.
Linda, Tybee Island, Georgia. You've mentioned working with sounds or music, focusing on one note at a time. Could you say more about how to do this?
Sometimes the circumstances in which one's practicing are not ideal. For instance, here in California, Mount Baldy Zen Center, it's a narrow valley, and across the valley there is a lodge where they sometimes have rock bands playing, or country bands playing music while we're meditating, and it just bounces straight across the valley. And people say, how can we meditate with this music? In South America, when I was there many years ago, there was a mariachi band playing in the square right below the meditation center. So we had mariachi music during the whole weekend retreat that we were there. And other times people find themselves in during the meditation, having this song go through their heads, and to them it's a distraction and they can't get rid of it. So in any of these circumstances, I've said to people, well, just listen to each note. Now, what makes a tune, what makes music music, is not the individual notes, but the relationships between the notes, the intervals, the variation in volume, and so forth. And if you just listen to each note individually, there isn't any music. And so there's no distraction. You're right in the experience of each note. Now, this is not particularly easy to do, because part of us just wants to hang back and listen to the music. But you can practice this by, and if you really want to learn how to do it, then put on something relatively slow, some kind of adagio or something like that, and listen to each note, and till you develop the facility and ability just to listen to every note one by one. The level of attention that it takes to do this will give rise to a higher level of attention in your practice, and you may find yourself able to listen and to be in the presence of all kinds of noises and not be disturbed by them at all.
Here's another question from Patrick in Montreal. Meditation, specifically Zen meditation, is a very individual practice that tends to limit verbal interactions between people. Can you speak of some traditional spiritual practices that engage people into open discussions? And should this be viewed as a hindrance to integration of spiritual practices in daily life?
To say that Zen meditation is a very individual practice, it can be looked at that way, but I think it could be looked at in other ways. Meditating together in groups is a very, very important part of Zen practice. It does tend to limit verbal interactions, because the verbal interactions are seen as a way that people dissipate energy. In dissipating energy, they weaken their attention. When you ask, can I speak of some traditional spiritual practices that engage people in open discussions? There are many forms of practice. David Bohm's dialogue work, for instance, engages people in open discussions. But the challenge here is, can you stay in attention and talk at the same time? For most people, the answer is no. They can sit in attention, but as soon as they open their mouth, they say whatever comes out, and often there's very little mindfulness, very little attention in it. So the real practice is learning how to speak in attention. And one way that I find very helpful for that is, whenever you are speaking, to listen to the sound of your own voice as if you are listening to another person. And you find that it changes the way that you speak. And you will say things, you'll be less inclined to say things that are inconsequential or mean or hurtful or anything like that. Not because you don't want to, it's because when you hear it, you will actually hear it and you will change how you speak quite naturally. If you can practice that, then you can talk as much as you wish because you're in attention when you're speaking. But the reason that a lot of verbal interaction is regarded as a hindrance to spiritual practice is because people aren't able to be in attention, to be present, to be mindful when they're speaking. But if you can be, then it isn't a hindrance.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.